Well, it's very good to see you again. Let me tell you about one of those interesting moments I had a few months ago. I'd parked our little old car with my two of my teenage sons, and just in front of us, there drew up a bright red Ferrari 355. Now, my sons are very interested in cars, and they were very impressed, and I was very impressed. And as this fantastically impressive car pulled up, and it just parked in front of us. Now, of course, we watched to see who got out, because I said to myself, and my sons said to themselves, if the driver of that car is anything like the car, then the driver's going to be really impressive. And so we watched agog as the driver's door opened. And to our great disappointment, this middle-aged, rather beer-bellied, unshaven, balding man got out and shambled off. And it was a great disappointment. And I thought to myself, it's not a very clever picture, but it is a little picture of the fact that what's inside doesn't necessarily correspond with what's outside. And the question that I want us to think about today from this very old book, the Book of Job, is the question, what are the marks of a real Christian believer? Because people often think a Christian is this or that or the other. Somebody said to my oldest son at his university the other day, he's a Christian, and somebody said to him, when he said he didn't know the answer to some question, he said, "Oh, I thought Christians knew all the answers." So this guy's definition of a Christian was someone who knows all the answers. But that's not what a Christian is. Sometimes people think a Christian is a self-righteous person, someone who thinks, "Well, I've got it together morally. I've got my life together, and poor old you haven't." That's not a Christian. And there are all sorts of wrong ideas of what a Christian is. And we're going to find in this very old book of Job two very surprising, at least one of them I think is very surprising, marks of a real Christian believer. And I think they may surprise us. If you're not a Christian, I'm delighted you're here. That's the purpose of these lunchtime talks. And if you're not a Christian, it's worth listening carefully to what a real Christian looks like. Because if you become a Christian, that might just be you. So it's worth listening carefully and seeing where we get to on this. Now, last week, some of you, I'm sure, have come this week for the first time and weren't here last week. Last week, we began this book of Job. Nobody knows when it was written. It's obviously set a very long time ago, and there it is in the Old Testament part of the Bible. And we introduced the book, and we looked at the first couple of chapters, or most of the first couple of chapters, where the most important characters are introduced. And we saw, I draw our atten our, drew our attention to four things last week. That the central human character in the book, Job, is a man who was very successful, wealthy and with a happy family, and blameless. And I explained last week in answer to a very good question that blameless does not mean perfect. So he wasn't perfect or sinless in Bible language, but he was blameless, which means he was a real believer. He really bowed down in his life and in what he said to the God who made the world. And when he went wrong, he said sorry and turned back from his wrong and walked in an upright way with God. That was the first thing we learnt last week. The second thing was that in the universe, as the Bible portrays it, and as I believe it to be, there is a Satan or devil, a real spiritual person, who is evil and who has real influence. And we met this Satan in the way that story is told at the beginning of the book last week. The third thing we learnt last week is that the God who made this world is in control. So we learnt that the Bible does not say there are two equal and opposite forces, a force of good and a force of evil, and they're battling it out, and you never quite know who's going to win. No, the Bible picture is that the God who made the world really is in control, and that the Satan or the devil, who brings evil and malice and viciousness and so on into the world, is real and has influence, but cannot do anything that the God who's in control doesn't give him permission to do. And the fourth thing we learned is that as the drama begins, God gives the Satan terrible permissions. And Satan asks permission to hurt Job, this blameless, upright man, and to our dismay, God says, "Yes, okay, And the Satan takes his, destroys his possessions. He was a wealthy farmer, and kills his children. And then in a second attack, destroys his health. So it was a pretty dreadful start to the book. Frankly, I'm a little surprised that anybody's come back this week. But I'm delighted to see that some of you are here. So thank you for coming. So that's just a brief recap of last week. We ended last week with a question. And the question is this man, Job, for whom everything was going so well, is he a real believer? And in the first couple of chapters, it looks like he is. He says all sorts of pious things. He says, well, God gave me everything, and now God's taken it away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And if God does that, that's up to God, and I must bless him anyway. And it sounds great. But we're wondering at the end whether this is real or whether he's just saying the pious things. Let me tell you briefly what happens between there and the parts that we're going to look at this week. At the end of the second chapter, three of Job's friends appear. There's a guy called Eliphaz and a guy called Bildad and a guy called Zophar. And they turn up. They've heard that Job is suffering and they turn up. And they're dismayed when they see him. They can scarcely recognize him. He's so worn and exhausted and grief-stricken and so on. And they sit with him in silence for a period, at the end of which Job bursts out in the most dark, heart-rending lament. And I commend it to you to read chapter 3, some later stage in your Bibles. Probably the darkest lament ever uttered by a believer, until the Lord Jesus Christ cried out on the cross, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" After Job's lament, his friends interrupt. And from chapter 4 to chapter 27, one friend speaks, and then Job replies, and then a second friend speaks, and then Job replies, third friend speaks, Job replies. They do that 2.5 times round, really, 2 2/3 times round. And it gets pretty heated. Let me summarize for you. Obviously, in those chapters, Job's friends say a lot, but I've put on the handout a summary of their system, because Job's friends have a very simple, cut-and-dried, neat system as to how the world works, and it runs like this. A, there is a God who is in control, and Job and the Bible would agree with that. B, they say the God who's in control is absolutely fair. Well, the Bible would agree with that, even if Job is wondering, as we shall see. C, therefore, this God who's in control and is fair punishes wrong behavior and rewards right behavior. And he always does that because he's fair, and he can do it because he's in control. And they say he does it without fail, and he does it pretty soon, and certainly he does it in this life. Therefore, conclusion D, if I suffer, I must have done something wrong. Actually, there's another conclusion as well, although it's not so relevant to the book of Job. And the other conclusion is that if things go well for me, I must have done something right. But it's a very simple, cut-and-dried system. So they see Job suffering, and they say to Job again and again and again, if you read through all their speeches, they say to Job, in effect, you say you're blameless, but actually we see you suffering, and so you can't be. You must be suffering because you've done something wrong. That's what they say to him, and Job repeatedly says, no, I'm not. He's not saying he's never done anything wrong, but he's saying anything he has done wrong, he's turned away from, and he's been forgiven. So that's what happens in between. Now, what I want us to do is to focus on Job himself. And obviously, Job says a great deal, and I'm just going to pick some parts, mainly from chapter 19, and you may want to ask questions about other parts. And obviously, in just one short talk, I can only summarize. But I want to make two points about Job. Before I make those points, let me say that if you read to the end, are you the kind of people who do read to the end of books? You know, if you're reading a whodunit, there are people who, you know, you read the beginning to see what they've done, and then you read to the end to see who done it, and then you decide whether you're going to read the in-between bits. A lot of people read Job like that. So last week we read what happened, who done what. And some people just skip to the end. Let me just tell you one thing from the end, which is that at the end, after Job and his friends have gone hammer and tongs for a long time, at the end, God says to the friends, or to one of the friends, he says, "You lot, Job's friends, have got it all wrong. But Job has spoken rightly of me." So that's the clue that as we read this in the context of the Bible, we're to see Job as a real believer and the friends with their very neat cut and dried system as not being so. Now here's the first mark of a real believer that I want to draw to our attention. You've got it on your second page. A real believer feels acutely the pain of God's unfairness. Now I want to explain what I mean by that. What I want to say is this, and I'll look at these passages with you in just a moment. Sometimes people speak about the problem of pain. The Christian writer C.S. Lewis wrote a very famous book called The Problem of Pain. And the problem of pain is very simple. It's not actually the problem of pain, it's the problem of unfair pain. And the problem of pain is very simple, and I'm sure that all of you who were here last week will have been asking it. You must have been if you weren't fast asleep, were bound to. The problem of pain says, if there's a God who's in control, and he's a good God, how come unfair things happen in the world? That's the problem of pain, or of unfair pain. Now the point I want to make is that the problem of pain is a problem for the believer, particularly, and that Job as a believer feels the problem of God's unfairness. So let's have a look. You see, number one, the first little extract I've given you there. This is one of Job's speeches in chapter 9, where you see Job says, "I am blameless." And he's feeling very despairing, and he says, "I regard not myself." That's to say, I'm past caring about myself. "I loathe my life. It's all one, it's all the same, you know, who cares? Therefore I say, he, that is God, destroys the blameless and the wicked. When disaster brings sudden death," you know, you hear about it on the media or read about it in a newspaper, "when disaster brings sudden death, God mocks at the calamity of the innocent." You know, somebody's in desperate pain, and God says, God is laughing at them and mocking at them, even though they don't deserve it. "The earth is given into the hands of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. That is to say, that's a way of saying that the judges don't do what's right. They turn a blind eye to evil, don't punish it, and don't vindicate right. If it isn't he, that is God, then who is it? So in this first little extract, Job accuses God of running the world very, very badly and of being some kind of monster. The same thing in the second one, Job, the second little extract. This is from chapter 16. It's another of Job's speeches. These are just little extracts. There wasn't room to print them all out. "Surely now God has worn me out," he says later. "He has torn me in his wrath and hated me. He set me up as his target." So Job, this real believer, says, the God who's made this world is just using me for target practice. He's like an archer, and he says, "Who shall I shoot an arrow at now? Oh, there's Job, ha ha ha, he's blameless. I'll shoot some arrows into him." That's what he says. It's a terrible accusation. It's what C.S. Lewis once called the image of God as a cosmic sadist. And then it gets very strong at the end of that second extract. "O earth, cover not my blood." Now that's Old Testament language, that when Cain killed Abel, right near the beginning of the book of Genesis, Abel's blood lay on the ground. And if somebody's blood is not covered, it means in Bible language that the fact that they were killed unfairly is crying out from the ground to be punished. If their blood is, as it were, covered, as it were, they're, you know, buried in a shallow grave and everybody forgets about them, it's a way of saying that something unfair has happened and it's never going to be put right. So Job says, "O earth, cover not my blood. Let my cry," that is my cry for justice, "find no resting place." So he's crying out for justice to be done. He's saying this is very serious. You know, it's the kind of thing if you had some kind of cosmic Hutton inquiry and God were found guilty of misbehavior, God would have to resign. That's the thrust of it. It's that serious. Now let's look at chapter 19. Chapter 19 is a very, very interesting chapter. We've got here verses 1 to 22. At the end of chapter 18, one of Job's so-called friends and comforters, Bildad, has given a blood-curdling description of what happens to the wicked. And Bildad, you remember their system, he says, anybody who's wicked, anybody who behaves wrongly, is bound to get clobbered. And the clear implication of Bildad's speech is, you're getting clobbered, Job, so you must have done something wrong, even though you're not pretending you haven't. Then Job answered and said, how long, he's speaking to his friends, how long will you torment me and break me in pieces with words? These 10 times you've cast reproach upon me, are you not ashamed to wrong me? And even if it be true that I have erred, my error remains with myself. And I think the sense of that is, even if I've done something wrong, and it's between me and God, and I've put it right, and why do you have to keep going at me like this? If indeed, verse 5, you magnify yourselves against me, make my disgrace an argument against me, know then that God has put me in the wrong and closed his net about me. You know, God has pointed at Job and said, guilty. And Job knows he isn't. Behold, I cry out violence. So he says, as God uses me for target practice, I cry out, well, somebody help me, I'm being treated unfairly, but nobody answers. I call for help, but there's no justice. He's walled up my way, so I can't pass. He's set darkness upon my paths. He's stripped from me my glory, which here I think means his reputation for being upright, taken the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side, and I'm gone, and my hope has he pulled up like a tree. He's kindled his wrath against me and counts me as his adversary. And then verse 12 is so prophetic. His troops come on together. They've cast up their siege ramp against me and encamp around my tent. And the picture of verse 12 is like this. Just imagine you'd gone camping on holiday, and it was just you in your little one-person tent. And you wake up in the morning and there seems to be a lot of noise around and you go outside your tent and you notice that you're surrounded by most of the armored divisions of the United States Army and that overhead there's the entire United States Air Force bombing you. That's the imagery of verse 12. Job is saying, it's just little me. And God has, he's put all his armies and all his Air Force and Navy, you know, they're all there and they're all there to attack me. That's how Job feels. And he feels that God is a monster. And then it goes on even more sad about how miserable he is. Verse 13 on the next page. He's put my brothers far from me. That is my brethren, the general sense of friends, neighbors, family. Those who knew me are wholly estranged from me. He's very lonely. My relatives have failed me. My close friends have forgotten me. The guests in my house, my maidservants, count me as a stranger. I've become a foreigner in their eyes. I call to my servant, but he gives me no answer. Remember, Job had been a very wealthy man. In the past, he'd snapped his fingers, his servants would have come running. Now he calls to his servant, and his servant just ignores him, says, who's that funny old man? That's how it is. He's very lonely and suffering abysmally. I must plead with him, 16, with my mouth for mercy. My breath is strange to my wife, that is, I'm physically repulsive to her. I'm a stench to the children of my own mother. His siblings can't stand to be near him. Even young children despise me. When I rise, they talk against me. You can imagine, can't you, the children coming back from school before they would have got off the pavement onto the road, walked respectfully around this very distinguished man. Now they just laugh at him, maybe throw a few stones, a bit of rotten fruit. 19, all my intimate friends have bore me, those whom I loved have turned against me. My bones stick to my skin, to my flesh. I've escaped by the skin of my teeth. That means I'm just about alive. Have mercy on me. Have mercy on me, O you, my friends, for the hand of God has touched me. Why do you, like God, pursue me? Why are you not satisfied with my flesh? So it's a very, very pathetic picture. But I want us to notice and to understand why it is that this real believer feels so awful. It's not just that he's lonely and suffering and in pain. I mean, God knows that's bad enough. Any one of us who's been like that, who is like that, or someone we love is like that at the moment. Any one of us who've sat with somebody like that. You know, that's grim enough. But it's even grimmer for Job, because he believes that there is a God in control of the world. And because he believes there's a God who's in control of the world, he's a real believer. He really does believe that there actually objectively is a God in control of the world. Because he believes that, he's convinced that if these bad things are happening to him, it must be God who's doing them. Can you imagine what that feels like? And I want to suggest to us that that's a mark of a real believer. If I am not a real believer, if I don't really believe that there is a good God in control of the world, I ought not to be troubled by unfairness. You know, unfair things should happen to other people or to me, and I ought to shrug my shoulders and say, well, it's just blind fate or chance. I oughtn't to be troubled by it. But if I'm troubled by it, which I am, it's a sign that somewhere deep inside me there is a sense that there is a real a God who's in control and who ought to be fair and good. So one of the marks of a real believer is to be very, very troubled by the problem of injustice and unfairness in the world. That's a mark of a believer, to be troubled. And if there's anyone who says they're a Christian and really isn't troubled by it, it's a sign of not being a believer. I mean, here's a quotation I came across from a survivor of Auschwitz during the early 1940s. And this survivor wrote this: "It never occurred to me to question God's doings or lack of doings while I was an inmate of Auschwitz. I was no less and no more religious because of what the Nazis did to us. And I believe my faith in God was not undermined in the least. It never occurred to me to associate the calamity we were experiencing with God, to blame him because he didn't come to our aid." Now, when I first read that, I thought that's a marvellous mark of faith to be able to say that. But the more I've thought about it, the more I've thought that actually that quotation is the mark of someone who's not really a believer. For someone, a believer could never say, this unfair thing's happened and it doesn't trouble my faith in God. A believer will always say, I'm very troubled by this. Because if there really is a God in control, and this ought not to be. Now, my second point, second mark of a believer. Nevertheless, a real believer holds on to the conviction that God will be proved fair in the end. See the first little quote there. Job said, "Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that is God, that I might come even to his seat." Job longs to meet this God, even though he thinks God's treating him unfairly. His friends think it's hopeless. You see the second little quote, one of his friends saying to him mockingly, "Call now, is there anyone who will answer you? You know, not a hope." See the third quote, Job laments, "There isn't an arbiter between us, or would that there were an arbiter between us who might lay his hand on us both. I wish there was someone who'd bring us together." Now the point is this, that Job longs to meet the God, even though he thinks this God is treating him unfairly. It's a little bit like, you know, sometimes in those romantic dramas, a girl thinks that her man is two-timing on her, cheating on her. And you know those sort of tempestuous scenes you get in soaps sometimes, where the girl shouts at the man, "You're horrible. You're a monster. Why do you treat me like this?" You know, that sort of anger. And we say, well, she's shouting like that because she hates him. But actually, we know that she's shouting like that, not because she hates him, but because she loves him, and she longs for him to prove to her that he isn't the monster he seems to be. That's the sense in which Job shouts at God. If Job really hated God, he wouldn't bother with God at all. But the reason he shouts at God so angrily is that he loves God, and he longs for God to prove to him that he isn't the monster that he seems to be. Now, at the end of chapter 19, we have one of the most remarkable examples of Old Testament faith. And I'm going to close with this, just with a brief final comment. He's just said all that stuff we've read about how God is treating him like a monster. And then he says, verse 23, "Oh, that my words were written, that is my testimony." Job says, I'm about to die, and I know very well that when I die, my friends will put on my gravestone, "Here lies Job, who said he was blameless, but actually he was a rotten old sinner, and that's why he's dead." That's what his friends are going to put. I mean, they've said that several times. So Job says, I'm going to be dead, and I just wish that my words, my testimony of my life, could be written, inscribed in a book. There's a certain irony about that, now that we're reading his book. "Oh, that with an iron pen and lead they were engraved in the rock forever, so nobody could rub them out." And then he goes on, "For I know that my Redeemer lives." And the word Redeemer in the Old Testament was used of a family member who would see that justice was done for one of their family when they were wronged. "I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth or upon the dust, maybe on my grave. And after my skin has been thus destroyed," that is after I've died, "yet in my flesh," he's not quite certain about that translation, but it may be that, but he's confident that he's going to see God after death, "whom I shall see for myself, my eyes shall behold, and not another. My heart faints within me," as we would say, "I've got butterflies in my tummy." Only it's a bit stronger than that. Now, what is Job saying? Job is saying, even though it seems that God is treating me like a monster, as a monster would, I'm convinced that the God who runs this world is finally going to be proved to be fair. And therefore, that a man or woman who goes through this life as a real believer, bowing before him and living a life of uprightness, turning from wrong, that a real believer is finally going to be vindicated. That's what Job says, that's when he says that. Now, question, is it wishful thinking? Because we could easily say, well, that was rather wonderful that Job said that in the midst of his pain, but actually it was just wishful thinking. That's because he wanted to believe that. It was a sort of psychological crutch. How do we know that it's true if we do? Well, the answer that Christian people give is this, that centuries later, a real believer walked this earth in absolute uprightness and innocence and was treated with utter and total unfairness and done to death after a travesty of a trial and nailed to a cross and died. And on the third day, God raised him in his body from the dead. And Christian people say, on the evidence of that one real physical bodily resurrection, which we believe to be true because we believe the people who saw it, we believe that on the last day, God is going to do that for every real believer, Job included. So the reason that Christian people believe that this is true is the resurrection of Christ, which is why, if you know Handel's Messiah, you know that lovely aria, I won't try and sing it to you because that would ruin the recording, where Handel took those words of Job, "I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth, and though worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God." And then the aria goes straight on, "For now is Christ risen from the dead, the first fruits of them that sleep." Now I'm going to stop there, and there may well be questions about that. But I hope I've been sufficiently clear. These two marks of a real believer, a real pain at why the world is so unfair, and yet a real confidence that in the end, the God who runs this world will be seen to be just and fair. So I'm going to stop there. We've got just a few minutes. I'm sorry I've overrun a bit this week. I'll try and do better next week. Just a few minutes for questions publicly, and then any questions privately after that when people have had a chance to go. Far away if you'd like to. One at the back, yes.
Is it a case then that being God's own fairness? Is the case of what we see as being God's own fairness our perception of God's own fairness? Is it actually it being all fair?
That in the end we will see that his purposes were fair and just. Yes.
Yeah.
It's beyond what our minds can get round. We can't, you know, real Christianity doesn't have a nice tidy system like Job's comforters. But yes. Yeah. Silence could indicate anything, couldn't it? Could indicate you agree. Could indicate you disagree so strongly you're not prepared to ask in public. Well, fair enough. I'm able to stay around for a few minutes, so do nobble me if there are other things you'd like to talk about. Next week we'll be looking at the question, why doesn't God answer me? Which is one of the great questions, as the book of Job unfolds. So join us if you can.